It's time for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. It's a discussion segment about things happening on and in the media. And in a world of both mass and personalized media, there's always lots to talk about. We do define media very broadly, taking in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. This month, we welcome our new permanent team. Christopher Lucas has been here before. He's on the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. He teaches video production and film and media studies. Chris, welcome back. Thanks for being a regular permanent guy.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
And Victoria Sama is brand new to us. She left CNN to become the chair of the Department of Journalism and Mass Communication at Humboldt State University, where she teaches reporting, production, media law, and more. Vicki, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's good to have you both. And you know, since we have you new here, I wanted to tap into your academic brains just a bit before we get into a discussion of things that are going on at the moment, because we had an interesting discussion off air about objectivity in reporting. And I wonder how you discuss this with your students in this day and age. Vicki, let's start with you.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff. The concept of objectivity is a controversial one and has been in discussions a lot recently in the news. But I will say that it's an old concept that is pretty outdated. And in my classroom, I've talked with my students about this concept in a book that we used in our ethics class called The Elements of Journalism by Bill Rosenstiel and Tom Kovac. Bill Kovac and Tom Rosenstiel.
Mm-hmm.
And this book was published in 2001 before social media was even a thing with the news, and it's been updated twice. But back then, journalists were basically asked the concept of objectivity and whether that was something that was important to their job responsibility, and they decided it was not. And they said what was really the most important part of their job was to be transparent and to allow the audience to see how they verified information and let the audience decide if there was a bias in it.
Mm-hmm. And so, Chris, I mean, the same texts, I'm sure, are out there for all mass media classes. Is this the same way you teach it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really the, you know, the way thinking in this professional practice has gone is really treating objectivity as a bit of a mirage. You know, it's not something when I get hung up on, there's other values that are really important. If you look at an organization like the Associated Press, right, the AP and the Influential Style Guide and a set of standards for the profession, they don't use the word objectivity, right? They use words like accuracy and honesty and balance and impartiality and quick. You know, one thing I think is often forgotten when we talk about journalism is the way that, you know, a lot of this work, all this work is really done on short timelines.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kind of principles of being accurate, being honest, and also being, you know, knowing where the potholes are, right? Sort of knowing not to be, you know, careless and being aware of your own tendencies towards distortion or bias.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of dealing with writing journalism. And I think those are much more useful concepts than objectivity.
This is a tricky thing for a young reporter, though. I know because I was once a young reporter, but, I mean, not knowing what you don't know really, in essence, gets into the picture, doesn't it, Vicki?
Yes, and, you know, we all come to a story with a bias. Sometimes it's implicit and sometimes it's not. And that's the conversations we're having with our young journalists today, is, you know, to be able to recognize that and to see how we do a story, when we're looking for sources, where we go, what are our source channels, and if we're constantly going to the same person to get that information or the same type of people to get that information and looking at why we have that. And usually it comes down to a level of comfort in who we want to approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting students to understand that it's important to get out of your comfort zone and to approach a story in a different perspective than you feel comfortable. And that could help undo some of the biases that we bring to a story. And in that case, we're talking more about, you know, having a little bit more, if you want to use the term objectivity, but like Chris just said, you know, that term is really a little bit outdated. And so we don't really use that. We're really more focused on getting the story in a way that is transparent, that our methods are transparent, that we can tell the audience so they understand how we did it, and they can criticize us for it, and then we respond to that.
Signals and Noise here on the Jefferson Exchange. Victoria Sama, brand new to us from Humboldt State University. Chris Lucas back in the fold permanently now from Southern Oregon University. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. So let's move off into the stuff that's really hot in the media world right now. The book by Donald Trump's niece, Mary Trump, Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, actually advanced its publication date once it cleared the courts by about 2 weeks. Chris Lucas, have you seen much in the way of the top five things, the top nine things? I've seen a couple of those already.
I think we're getting a lot of inside looks at the what sounds like a pretty toxic atmosphere inside of that family, which I think is not a great surprise. I mean, a lot of things I'm seeing haven't really been surprising me. I feel like we've had over the last 4 or 5 years, we've learned a lot about certainly the president and his family and his dealings, and so nothing really kind of breaks the mold here. In some ways, I think I'm like a little less interested in this book for the kind of soap opera qualities of it, which I think is how a lot of the press is treating it. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a War of the Roses feeling to it. These kind of East Coast rich folks going at each other. I don't want to kind of derail this too much. I'll just say I think I'm really interested in this confidentiality agreement that was preventing or seemed to be preventing Mary Trump from bringing this out. Because if you go back about a year, The Atlantic did a really interesting article about the misuse of confidentiality agreements, mm-hmm. NDAs, which is a very widespread phenomenon. And here's a case where it sort of failed. And I think, if that could be tested, I think that would be a really beneficial outcome of this case.
Vicki, in media law, do you discuss things like non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements?
Absolutely. The confidentiality agreement that's being discussed in this case has a little bit less to do with the media than the president's niece Mary's conflict with the family, that they said they confided in something and they had an agreement to something, but apparently the value of the real estate was way undervalued, and so she says, well, then the confidentiality agreement is void because it was based on false information about the properties. And so they had agreed to a certain amount of a settlement with the family. There's a lot of interesting things about this book that are absolutely, I agree with Chris, as far as not the inner workings of the family, described as dysfunctional, and the president supposedly, she claims that he had someone take a test for him to get into graduate school or to business school. So I think, those little details are not as interesting to me as much as the confidentiality issues and also what the courts are doing right now. I mean, the family, obviously, the Trump family sued to try to stop Simon & Schuster from publishing the book, and they've won that court battle. So now the book can go ahead and be published, and it'll be interesting to see if there is a post-publication lawsuit that comes up for perhaps libel or something else after it's released in a week or two.
So that's really what this comes down to, it seems like, is that most of the stuff in the book is, it sounds like no big surprise to a lot of people, but the stuff that goes on within the family legally is what will end up rising to the top over time.
That's where I'm more mm-hmm. interested. I'm always interested in the legal aspect of it, especially when it's dealing with the publisher. So for me, that's the media law aspect of it. Mm-hmm. The fact that the having enjoined the publication originally, or trying to restrict the publisher from putting out the book, and they won that battle, which is I'm happy to see that.
Let's move
going
on.
Back
go,
to our
go, Chris.
I was going to say, going back to our our initial conversation, I see NDAs or confidentiality agreements as sort of an enemy of transparency and an enemy of good journalism. So to the extent that they can be challenged, I think there's some possible positive benefits here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the reporter's bane. It's like, don't talk to them. Yeah, all those, which is what an NDA really is all about. Let's talk about social media now and Facebook and facing this advertiser boycott from people saying you need to stop hate for profit, the way that Facebook is very reluctant to clamp down on what goes out into the world because they consider themselves a free speech platform. Vicki, take this one on.
Well, I will say, first of all, in speaking about free speech or talking about First Amendment issues, Facebook is not the government. So when it comes to Facebook, it's a private entity. It's a private business. It is not the government. And so First Amendment issues do not apply. Private entities can do whatever they want, essentially, and not violate someone's First Amendment. So to clarify that, just to let them know. And, you know, so they're going to have to deal with the pushback from their users. Any decision that Facebook is going to make as far as, advertising may interrupt the users that want that advertising or that see that as a political move and it doesn't fall in line with their politics. It's going to be felt in the dollar.
Chris, thoughts about the boycott and the aims of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly really notable because you have some pretty sort of powerful civil rights organizations here, the Anti-Defamation League, NAACP, Color of Change, involved here. And they're successful at getting Facebook to the table to talk about this topic. They just had a meeting on Tuesday, which, from what I read, didn't actually go that well. I guess to my mind, Facebook is an extremely powerful company between, they and Google essentially operate as a duopoly in the digital advertising space now. Upwards of 1,000 advertisers have backed away from Facebook, although they're calling it a pause. It's a temporary break, which just goes to show, I think a lot of organizations, especially sort of mid-sized and smaller businesses, Facebook is their marketing strategy. There isn't really a plan B, and maybe and some have business models built around Facebook. So, Facebook is an extremely powerful kind of economic position here. So I am worried that, this will eventually kind of slope off into essentially a kind of a public relations exercise. I hope not, but there's always, always just have a fear or a sense that Facebook is willing to kind of make these superficial moves or these kind of appearances to be thinking about this topic, but it's a really difficult problem of how to stop kind of hateful or abusive content on this platform. They don't really have the infrastructure to do it. And I think we're a long way from really seeing this problem solved.
This is our regular monthly media overview, Signals and Noise, with our new regular team, Chris Lucas from Southern Oregon University and Victoria Sama from Humboldt State University. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's stay in the Facebook Google zone and talk about Hong Kong with the change in laws there that essentially gets rid of the idea of Hong Kong having a democratic system until 2047. Facebook and Google have at least for the moment paused in agreeing to give any user information to the Hong Kong, aka Chinese government. What do you make of this, Vicky?
Yes, this is really an interesting phenomenon that's happening. This new security law imposed by China on Hong Kong that just was this week is forcing a lot of the social media organizations like Facebook and Google, which have large data centers in China, to either comply with the law or face some serious repercussions. Because they have these data centers, the Chinese government can go in there and make arrests of their personnel and their staff. So, it's going to be interesting to see if they comply. So if the new law says that, there's people calling for democracy and these organizations, the civil rights organizations that want to use Facebook and call for a meetup, and the Chinese want to find out that information, does Facebook hand it over or face these possible repercussions? So it's going to be very interesting to see how Facebook and Google in particular handle this these new requirements of them.
They got a lot on the line and a lot of criticism in the past for playing footsie with the Chinese government. That's not a real technical term, I realize. But Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, we're obviously really early days in this. I think it's maybe like less than a week since the new rules were passed in Hong Kong that allow the police to take down internet content or punish the internet companies and their employees. So obviously a really chilling development there. And, you know, kind of a bellwether, I suppose, just on what the future is going to be in Hong Kong and in China. Of course, Facebook and Google are taking the lead here and paused the review of these requests. Other companies are also doing the same, Twitter, Zoom, Microsoft. I think they're in a real bind. It's a huge market. I kind of feel like we're just going to see the enclosure of Hong Kong here eventually. I've been watching with a great deal of interest TikTok, which, you know, is an extremely popular platform as well. And TikTok had been the global version of this. I guess it's a social media form, it's kind of an entertainment app. But of course, there was a kind of a special TikTok for just the Chinese market because they have a different relationship with the government inside of China, and the Chinese version of TikTok is still operating in Hong Kong. The global version of TikTok has removed itself. So to me, that kind of maybe paints the path forward.
Interesting. So, yeah, globalization and politics and media all colliding here. Let's move on to the topic of doom scrolling. And Chris, I think you might have brought this up first in our previous discussion. What is that?
Well, doom scrolling, I think it was a bit tongue-in-cheek. It ended up showing up in the Urban Dictionary. I've seen it as early as mid-March, but really this is just a way of talking about people's habit of continuously scrolling through bad news or upsetting information, especially, for instance, when you wake up in the morning and get into your phone, and then you spend the next 15 minutes going, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. And so some clever person turned this doom scrolling, but it's turned into a larger conversation just about the kind of, you know, the psychological impacts of this and maybe of our social media diets more generally. And I think that's worth thinking about. You know, I think there is certainly an emotional cost to be had if, you know, you see a lot of this really negative content, and then you find yourself kind of unable because of the somewhat addictive qualities of social media. We just kind of stay plugged in, and then it starts to, you know, maybe there's risk of depression and other ill effects.
I can relate. There are times that I'm in the Facebook feed, and it's like, okay, one more thing. I just need one more good thing.
Right.
Or one more bad thing. Vicky, do you do doom scrolling yourself?
I avoid it at all costs. But I do, you know, this is the thing, it is a conundrum. It's human nature that we want information, right? We need information to navigate our day. We need to know what the weather is going to be, or, you know, what's happened in our neighborhood and what's on sale tomorrow, whatever. Those are the main, you know, the minor things. But what happens is we get addicted to other types of information that seem to be way more dramatic and more interesting, or there's something about it that is sort of addictive, and we can't stop, and we can't stop ourselves. Whether it's a YouTube type of video, if you put a search of a word in YouTube, it might just bring up a bunch of different videos, and you find yourself, you just can't stop watching or reading about that same topic over and over, and you just go through. And, you know, maybe there's a certain type of PTSD that comes from this kind of constant information overload into our brains. I think it's unhealthy for sure. And it's funny, I have a friend who I've recently been talking to who's just scrolling about everything about Trump and anything that Trump says or anything that he does. And the first thing in the morning is I'll get a text about what Trump did today. And I said, you know, you need some balance in your life. If you're constantly doing that, it's going to make your day start a little bit more tense. So I think balance is important. And I, you know, it might be hard to see what the reaction is or the impact of this kind of thing. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, doing searches for Donald Trump is doomsday, but it, you know, anything, I think any one kind of topic that it has a lot of, you know, stress related with it could make you feel that way.
Well, it's a sort of a rage mechanism. You know, it's the things that annoy you are the things that we tend to go for first. And I thought of doom scrolling as I can't go to bed until I finish this thing. But it sounds like your friend does it first thing in the morning too. So there's some stuff to think about.
Let's I tell my students, just don't mistake the picture of the world you see through your social media feed as as the actual world.
excellent advice. So, Chris, while we're on you, we got about 2 minutes for pick threes from each of you. Why don't you go 1, 2, 3, your media choices for the month?
Sure. Well, on topic, I want to recommend folks look up a documentary called Fake, Searching for Truth in the Age of Misinformation. It's going to be on PBS this weekend, our local PBS station.
Mm-hmm.
It's also available on their streaming platforms, and I think free online if you just search for it, Fake, Searching for Truth in the Age of Misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
Really great short doc. Another documentary, Crip Camp, is on Netflix, and this is an award winner at Sundance last year. It's
mm-hmm.
a story of a summer camp that was for teens with disabilities, a really, really sweet and uplifting, actually, documentary. And then finally, a movie called First Cow. I'm trying to remember if I had mentioned this to you before, Jeffrey, but this is Kelly Reichert's new film.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly Reichert, a filmmaker who's done a lot of films about Oregon, based in Oregon. This is she's not based in Oregon, but the film, most of her films are. And this is a film, she kind of goes back to the pioneer days, which she's done before, in a very interesting tale about two ambitious guys who have a plan for a cow. And Reichert,
okay, I want to leave it there because I need to get Vicky's pick three in. So go ahead, Vicky.
Oh, yeah, I've got two instead of three today, but I told my faculty and staff I'm really working on my social justice sort of knowledge, and so I'm watching this documentary. It's not new, but it's called 13th.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the 13th Amendment, and it deals with the documentary about incarceration, race, justice, and it's a very interesting documentary. And I'm reading a book called Ghosts of Gold Mountain, and it's a story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad,
mm-hmm.
basically the western portion from Sacramento to Omaha. And it's a really insightful book of the struggles that the Chinese had after they built not only during, but afterwards. And it's a really interesting book by Gordon Chang. That's a new book I recommend.
And the thing on 13th was called 13?
It's called 13th.
13th, okay. 13th. And Ghosts of Gold Mountain from Vicky. Fake Camp and First Cow from Chris Lucas, our regulars on Signals and Noise. Thank you both for joining us. We'll talk to you next month.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Take care.